Okay, I'm going to try and fit some numbers to the overview that you just heard from a recent talk. I mean, a study that we did. And this is my research team, and SRBI was the survey research company that helped us out. I'll talk a little bit about the prevalence. Talk about who's doing it. Sort of draw your attention to the fact that this is a domestic violence problem. My definition of elder mistreatment was widened in this study to also include stranger assault, because I thought we need to know about all the victimizations, not just familiar or trusted other, and then just ask who did it. So you'll see both, and then look at some risk factors. Now, one thing before we start, my study was limited to community residing older adults. And the reason for that is that it's my position that a very different methodology is needed for cognitively impaired relative to cognitively intact older adults. Two entirely different populations, and what works with one will not work with the other in terms of identifying. Now, historically, elder abuse was looked at a lot like child abuse. Stereotypical conceptions of who's being assaulted or, you know, nursing home or weak or frail elderly by youthful caregivers with limited cognitive ability. But our initial pilot data showed that it was more of a domestic violence problem on two cognitively intact, relatively independent adults, one on the other. So the child abuse model, both of conceptualization and intervention, probably wouldn't fit. And the risk factors for preventive intervention would be different. So that was sort of our starting point. And again, the cognitive status is essential, because you will have different risk and protective factors, you will have different responding rates, you'll have different types of assessment. So get right into it. This took 15 years to get funded. And it was only funded halfway. We didn't get outcomes, so I don't know the mental or physical health outcomes of these events. This was stripped down to be a prevalent study to demonstrate whether or not it's even important to study. So I assume in the next 15 years we'll get to do an outcomes study. We use computer-assisted interviewing procedures, and we use telephones. That would reach about 93% of the community residing older adults. In two languages, Spanish and English, and that 7% would be households without phones, about 4 to 5%, and households with hearing problems that wouldn't allow them to participate. So we got a good sample. And the cooperation rate, this is one of the reasons it's very nice to study older adults. They generally are more cooperative than younger adults. So we had a pretty good cooperation rate for a random digital survey. Normally they're closer to 50%. The mistreatment types we assessed, and remember, the perpetrator could have been anybody, even strangers, were emotional, physical, sexual, and neglectful. We also did financial. I'm not terribly confident that our assessment of that was great, so I'm not going to talk about it. Borrowing from the younger adult literature on interpersonal violence and the studies that we've done at my center, we identified some risk factors or factors for protection, hopefully, or intervention, and, you know, age, gender, income, that type of thing. Perceived health status, with the idea that, you know, ironically, higher connections with service providers in the healthcare system, meaning more sentinel oversight for our abuse, might result in protection. Or the opposite, you know, more healthcare needs might be more caregiver burden, stress, et cetera, et cetera. So we didn't know. It could go both ways. Prior traumatic event exposure. This is tremendous in younger adult populations. Sort of bad things beget bad things beget bad things, unfortunately. Perceived social support. We wanted to know about the impact of social support, not only as a predictor, but also a risk, but also as maybe an area that we could intervene if it did come up. Now, this is an area that's come up in my research on disaster victims with younger adult disaster victims, older adult disaster victims. My other hat is a clinician at the VA with post-traumatic stress disorder individuals returning and recently and in distant past. It seems to be the most important thing you can study. It seems to be transcending everything. So that was something that we wanted to study. Use of social services. We thought that if they were more connected, maybe there'd be less abuse. And then functional impairment. Do they need help with daily living? Would that be a predictor? All right, really quickly, about 5,500 older adults, 60% women, average age 70. A lot of them married or cohabitating, a little bit more than half. And then an ethnic and racial overview of the country for that age group, lower than the younger groups, but about right for the age group. Looking at our risk factors to give you some rates, a lot of them are very poor. Older adults on fixed incomes do have economic problems. Obviously, the unemployment or retirement was high, but still, we wanted to look at that. Were those 20% still in the workforce getting better protection, for example? Only a fifth reported that their self-rated health was pretty poor. More than half had a prior traumatic event that overlays pretty well with other literature. Bad things happen to people. And then you see the other risk factors there. All right, emotional mistreatment, just to put the definition, actually not just to give you the overview of the definition, this is how we actually asked it. So we had this contextually oriented preface statement. You needed to orient people to the fact that this could have been done by a stranger or a significant other or caregiver or anybody. And we need to orient them to the time frame. And so we started, these are borrowed from the National Research Council sort of hints of what we should ask, and we just went for it. So basically, these are the conversations that if a police officer overheard, he should probably come over and stop this interaction. That's sort of what we gauged it as. But here's the breakout in case you didn't think some of them really met it. Overall, it's about 4.6%. Now, this is past year and since age 60. So elder abuse for older adults and then sort of current. And about 4 to 5% is what we look at. And those are the breakouts of the subtypes. Obviously, they'll add to more than 4.5% because more people have more than one thing happening. Splitting it by gender, pretty even spread. Again, the taller bar is since age 60. Now, who's doing it? This is an interesting slide, I think. Strangers. Strangers are not doing most of it. Shouldn't be terribly surprising. What was surprising for me is that acquaintances are doing a hell of a lot of it. People are being mean to each other. And then you have the domestic violence type of thing, but not just partners. Domestic violence in older adults is not just partner to partner. If you think of domestic violence as adult family member against adult family member, then you have a lot more potential perpetrators in a family. So we have a lot of domestic violence going on. Now, to give us an idea of how we can target or what's going on, these are the characteristics of the perpetrator. Now, obviously, this doesn't include the stranger assaults, but if you knew about the perpetrator, here's what you would talk about. Just to give you an overview, you know, about half lived with, a third were in counseling that they knew about, a third had substance abuse problems, or I should say a quarter in counseling. Unemployment was high, isolation, few friends. The victim was dependent, less so for women, more so than men. Just to give you an overview, when we ran the logistic regressions, the individual risk factors, not considering any other risk factor, are all given here. The ones in red are the ones that were still significantly predictive of risk after you controlled for each other. Call your attention to low social support and lower age. Those are the two high ones. So this will be a recurring theme. So basically, employment and social support, two most modifiable risk factors. Just to go back to show you what I'm talking about here. Oh, can't go back. Being employed was a risk factor. The opposite we thought. Apparently, workplace aggression, verbal aggression, is not limited to younger people. But overall, we have domestic violence or violence among family members is the major thing. It's not a terribly big surprise, but at least we have some indication of who's doing it and where. Switching to physical assault, and I'm going to move a little bit more quickly. These are sort of defined according to legal standards of physical assault. 1.6%. So this is a low number, and that makes me feel that my numbers are pretty accurate. And since age 60 rate is not too much different, it should normally be higher, but for past year, for our 61-year-olds, you might get an overlap there. But about 1 to 2%, and slightly more in men. That overlays with the younger adult population. But look at this. For women, physical abuse is not by a caregiver, or if it's by a caregiver, it's the caregiver who's a spouse. For men, it's about a third. For women, it's, you know, more than two-thirds. And this is community residing older adults, guys. What this tells you is domestic violence doesn't stop with age. It probably continues. Again, stranger assaults are very low. So for older adults, stranger perpetrated violence is not a very big problem relative to younger adults. But domestic violence is, and if you include family members in that overall thing, look at 80% of the perpetrators for women live with them, about half for men. And substance abuse was a tremendous problem. These are modifiable risk factors, though. It's not an unchangeable event, although it might be difficult. What are the two predictive risk factors? Lower age was more predictive of risk, and again, low social support. Now, all of these came up on individual chi-squares, but when you do a logistic regression to control for everything, you get lower age and low social support. Again, a risk factor of 3. Again, domestic violence is the deal. Sexual assault. Now, this is going to be extremely low in men, so we have a little bit of a problem with cutting that pie too small, but that won't stop me from reporting the pie. These are the definitions, and sort of overlay with what we ask in the younger adult samples and what the general population of researchers has asked. And this is nicely, thankfully, relatively low, although it's still about 1 in 100. Past year. Remember, these are past year, and people live to, what, 70, 80, so the risk is aggregate. There is a significantly higher number of women reporting sexual assault than men in the community, and that's consistent across ages. Again, this pie is cut pretty small for men, more stable for women. None of our people, over about 3,000 women, none of them reported a stranger assault since older adulthood, but those that did report reported people who knew them or they knew or their spouse. That's a 40% rate of sexual assault by a spouse, or 40% of the poor population. For comparison, in younger adults, it's about 24%. And then what do they look like? Well, I don't trust the dark blue, the pink representing the women. These are all targets for intervention again. Substance abuse is still a problem, less so, but still a problem. Isolation seems to be a problem. And again, I didn't run the risk ratios because the N was too small, but social support did come up on the individual risk predictors again. So, going real fast to neglect. Neglect is hard to define because the perpetrator is assumed to be the caregiver. But what if there's not a caregiver there? Well, then in my mind, the perpetrator is the community or the state. This person still has an unmet need. So we defined it in a couple of ways. One in which they had an unmet need, getting medicine, getting to healthcare, and they didn't have anybody that they could turn to for that, meaning state, community, greater extended unnamed family as perpetrator, or they had an unmet need and they had somebody identified but they weren't doing it. So these are the basic needs that have come up over and over in the literature. Transportation, enough food, help you do things like cook meals if you need it, someone to help you keep your house livable and safe, someone to help you get out of bed, someone to help make sure you get the bills paid. The probable neglect, now that's when you have a need, you have somebody who is supposed to help you, meaning we could actually have a prosecution, and they're not doing it is only 0.5, but the potential neglect is the thing that concerns me. This is older adults in our community saying, I have a need, I have nobody to help me with it. And the main thing is maintaining, it's sort of logical, what do older adults have harder and harder time doing? Well, maybe getting up on ladders, pushing the lawnmower in the sun, this type of thing. Okay, slightly more women than men. Look, low social support, there it is again, greater than twice the next highest level. That one sort of is obvious because it's neglect, and if they felt supported, they wouldn't feel neglected. But then we have low income, obviously that's going to be a problem, and health. Basically, the thing I'm trying to sell with this talk is that the major risk factor for elder mistreatment is a modifiable risk factor. And it's low social support. We got a 10% past year elder mistreatment rate on a very conservative survey. and 6% if you omit neglect. That's 1 year, which to me is relatively high in this industrialized, non-poor country. Domestic violence seems to be a very high-level problem. So to conceptualize elder abuse as you would child abuse is probably missing the point. These are independent adults where compelled reporting in most states is probably questionable, meaning if somebody hears about it in the healthcare profession, they're probably not going to report it because the statutes aren't as clear as they are for child abuse or for demented elders. Skipping down to the bottom one, social support is a thing that keeps on coming up. These are just some review of what we saw, and I'll get to the main thing. Here's the soapbox talk. When we study older adults after disaster, social support is the most protective factor against post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and generalized anxiety disorder. When we study older adults who are being abused, low social support is the biggest predictor of abuse. When we study the returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans wearing an entirely different hat, social support is the greatest predictor of not having the post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis. And if you have it, it's the greatest predictor of a positive prognostic response to treatment. So, how can we help older adults with social support? It seems that transportation is a very concrete way. I'm getting very drilled down here. Transportation is a very concrete way to reconnect older adults. That seems to be a crisis issue in this country, particularly in cities or outside of cities where public transportation is there. Now, in Charleston, South Carolina, where I am working, we have public transportation. It's laughable, but we have it. But you can't use it if you're an older adult. The average temperature this summer was over 90 degrees. Even if you only have to wait 10 minutes in the sun, you might die. Seriously. And none of our bus stops have shelters in Charleston. It's very rare for a corner bus stop to have a shade. So transportation is one way we could do it. It cuts across various demographics. The senior-friendly cities where they walk outside, they go to a place to get their bread, they go to a place to get their milk, they go to a place to get their coffee, they can take transportation to the library. Everything is like the old-fashioned community. Those elders seem to thrive. And people in the community know very rapidly when something is wrong. Whereas our suburban isolation has the opposite effect. So that's a take-home point.